KFMB.
San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you live from KFMB with 50,000 watts of power with the award-winning It's Your Money and Your Life. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, L.A. County, up the coast to Seattle on a good night, down to Baja, out to the desert, and now over to the main man of the hour. He's a CPA extraordinaire, an accomplished marathon runner, a best-selling author, and a family office expert to several high-net-worth families. He's a family man, a good father, and all-around good guy. His name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you tonight on this wet weekend?
I'm doing well. I took my rowboat in here to the studio. About 2 feet of water running down Convoy.
I got here. I was a little paranoid. I don't want to tell you how early I got here, but I had work to do anyway. But anyway, pretty busy week this week, eh?
Yeah, we were out at Warwick's Monday night for my latest book signing. We had 30-something people there, and we had a lot of fun. So I wanted to thank Nancy and Julie over at Warwick's in La Jolla.
Absolutely, Nancy Warwick, where you bought those scrapbooks in 1973.
Exactly. Did a book signing at a place where I bought scrapbooks in 1973.
Now, you know, I've been in touch with Bobby Riggs' daughter, Dorothy, and she asked where the scrapbooks are. And you did mention Monday night that one is in the Tennis
Hall. One is in the Tennis Hall of Fame in Newport, Rhode Island, but the others are in the possession of the Bobby Riggs Tennis Club and Museum.
Up in Encinitas.
Morning Kuehl. He was a guest on our show, I think, at the 40th anniversary of the Mother's Day Massacre.
All right, so there's two more, right? There's two more? There's a total of three?
No, that means Lorne has about 11.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, if you stack them up, they come up to my chest
from the floor to my chest.
That's how if you stack them, that's how high they are.
Oh my gosh! Well, Bobby liked things well stacked, but we'll leave that for another discussion. let's see what else. Are we ever going to digitize those? By the way, because I mentioned that
one has been, and one of these days I'll get to the other one.
Yeah, well, that's how. So how many total pages?
2,500. That's 11.5 by 17 paper, Joe. It's not 8.5 by 11.
15-year-old young.
Well, I started when I was 14.
Yeah.
So I was precocious or something.
Well, you know, I don't think I've ever... We're going to have to go up there. I know we went up there for one day when they were filming the movie last...
I brought one of the scrapbooks in studio way back when.
Really? I'll have to... Okay.
But I don't know that you noticed it. I don't know how you could miss it. It was like carrying a computer console.
You know, we should actually we should have a special event and a tour of the museum because we were up at that day and it is kind of cool. And maybe you could go over and dig out some of the highlights of the scrapbooks.
Absolutely.
That's fun stuff to go through.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you, Warwick's. And then morning I ran the Finnish Chelsea's Run 5K.
Yes, big turnout.
Chelsea King, huge turnout despite the weather. A funny story. So I'm driving down the 163 to go park to start the race. And of course, there's this massive hailstorm. And the person in front of me, who's like in the middle lane, stops. They don't pull over to the shoulder and stop. They stop in the middle of the freeway because you couldn't see.
What the hell?
Well, that's what I said. I said, what the hell are you doing? I mean, just pull over to the shoulder and stop if you can.
So this is on 163?
Yeah, going south, to get up on Washington
They just decided to stop on the freeway.
Yeah, so this huge hailstorm about 45 minutes before the race goes off, and then the clouds blow through and the sun comes out.
It was
sunny for the whole event, and then the rain comes back.
How long was this person stopped there, by the way?
I don't know. I went around him. I wasn't going to find that out.
Maybe his car stopped.
I was running late. So, I get there late, and I couldn't find... I was on Nathan Fletcher's team, and I couldn't find the person with my bib and my chip.
Right.
So, I just jumped in and ran with everybody, because by the time I decided I couldn't find them, I had to go to the restroom and then get in line and run.
Was it pretty dry for the run, or did it...
The sun came out for the whole thing. It was unbelievable.
And then it got raining a little later.
And then
later.
It came back when the thing was finishing up.
The rain did. Yeah.
So it went really, really well.
But a little rain's not going to hurt, for gosh
sake. So anyway, finished Chelsea's run.
Look at the Blackhawks in there. They're playing at 4-degree weather in the snow in Chicago.
Right? So anyway, I'm glad that the weather cleared up, at least for the event itself.
It was a big success. I saw it.
It was a huge success. And of course, having a couple of events myself, I know how the weather can really, really stress you out.
But her parents are great. I guess they're trying to get more laws passed in other states with all the resources.
Of course, our buddy Nathan Fletcher was behind some of the legislation that... constituted an improvement.
Absolutely. He was a key figure in that.
Exactly.
No doubt about that. But
anyway, we've got some great guests. So let's pick some Academy Award winners and get rolling.
Well, I printed out the sheet for us of all those in the best picture. I mean, I said pick the one you would like to win and one you think will win. I would like Wolf of Wall Street to win. I think 12 Years a Slave may win, but And I know I wanted DiCaprio to win for Best Actor, and I wanted Judi Dench for Best Actress. And I think you pretty much coincided with those.
We were pretty consistent.
So we wanted to, I wanted to have a wager with you, but we were.
There's really nothing to bet on.
Yeah, and I'd hate to. Yeah, I mean, I think 12 Years will win, but I'd hate to say, you know.
And I'll vote for Judi Dench for anything.
Okay.
Anything.
All right. Well, let's hope those all win, and we won't get into the other categories because it just gets too unwieldy, though.
Yeah, but let's get rolling. We got one guest on the line. We also have one guest in studio. Guest in studio is going to come on in the second half. That would be Mr. Malcolm Avner. So if anybody hears a voice, it's not a disembodied voice.
We asked him.
Malcolm is with us.
We said it's okay if he had a question or comment.
If he has questions or comments.
But on the line, who do we have? We've got
Carl Sheeler.
Correct.
One of our great sponsors, now with Berkeley Research Group. And Carl was supposed to be in studio, but he's not feeling that well because
he's under.
I guess he got a virus either in Boston or Chicago.
So, Carl, you're there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, wonderful.
How you feeling, Carl?
Well, I'm feeling well enough to be entertained by both of the
prognostications.
Yeah.
I'm doing well. I can even string a few words together.
Okay, good. Okay. Good.
We've all overcoming some recent mishaps. I had a bad infection on my left hand. My whole arm blew up, and I've been on antibiotics. So
and Richard's not willing to talk about his mishap in public. So.
I was going to say Joe is just relying on his right hand lately.
There you go. But I'm bumped. Anyway, let's tell him about Carl. Who is Carl Sheeler, Richard?
Carl Sheeler is the best business valuation resource. Well, I think on the planet, but certainly west of the Mississippi. And it's because he doesn't just do valuations based on history and tell you what the value of something is. He's actually very entrepreneurial in his approach. He assists businesses with identifying the risks that basically drive the value and the success of the companies that he values, and how by making certain changes or making certain improvements or gaining a better understanding of those risks and how they drive value, actually helping business owners improve or increase the value of their businesses by reducing the risks through greater understanding of the risks involved. So it's a very entrepreneurial approach to business valuation. Most valuation experts are thought of people who just sort of crank out after-the-fact numbers. Mm-hmm. And Carl, of course, can do that, but he goes well beyond that in terms of providing this forward-looking value.
Now, he's recently had a big business merger, correct?
Yeah, Carl, tell us about your merger.
Yes, so on the West Coast, our operations were absorbed by Berkeley Research Group. It's a global firm with 27 offices, about 650 employees.
Wow.
And the clientele tend to be primarily from 8 to 11 figures in annual revenues. As an example, we're involved in a case representing AIG against its suit against the federal government for a reduction in value based on some of the things that perhaps the government is alleged to have done.
Mm-hmm. 650 professionals, but you're a director, Carl. How many directors are there?
Within the organization, I'd have to take a look. I know that, generally speaking, most of the directors have advanced degrees.
Mm-hmm.
I would say equity partners, which are also directors, somewhere in the neighborhood of about 80.
Wow. Outstanding.
So things going smoothly with the merger, or has it been more work than you thought it was going to be?
Well, you know, it's a great question. I don't mind the work, particularly if I get well compensated for it. So I have been bouncing around not only on the East Coast, but as you know, also spent some time in both Dubai and Mumbai, mm-hmm. Associated with some of the activities in that family office, family business space that you're well acquainted with, Richard.
Good. So anyway, hey, tonight we're going to talk about conscious capitalism. And as I mentioned, Malcolm Avner's in the studio. I know you know Malcolm.
Yes.
But we wanted to chat with you about this topic or this subject called culture. Most people, at least professionals, CPAs, attorneys, when they think about valuing businesses or valuing other things, they don't really think about culture. They think about things like cash flow and profit and loss statements and, you know, tangible asset value and intangible asset value. But culture can be a very, very big part of valuation as well as risk with regard to valuation. Can you give us a brief background about why culture is important in the work that you do?
Absolutely. As you know, I'm currently writing a book for John Wiley and Sons, and it's currently titled Value Creation. It's Greek to me, and Greek is actually trademark spelled G-R-R-K, and the first letter is governance, the second is relationships, the third is risk, and the fourth is knowledge. So underneath the G, culture becomes a very relevant component. Anybody that's been involved in merger and acquisitions is often familiar with most mergers. When they fail, it's due to a cultural misfit. And so for my standpoint, culture means much more than, hey, this is what we believe in. It embodies the spirit and the focus of the employees, the communication, and also the way that they're going to conduct business and why. Mm-hmm. It is much deeper than just the word.
So the why gets down to a business's purpose, for example, correct?
It's driving force. It's reason for existing and differentiating.
You know, I just saw this this CEO of Apple, Tim Cook. He got angry at the climate change deniers, I believe, at a shareholders meeting. And there's a quote here. He says, if you want me to do things only for ROI purposes, you should get out of this stock. Now, I thought that was quite a statement. And they're trying to do as much sustainable energy at Apple as possible. I thought that definitely set a cultural trend, don't you? Or made a cultural statement.
I think it is why that Apple has been so successful in devices that, candidly, others have designed. The iPad, as an example, was actually developed well before Apple came out with their iPad. There had been other tablets, because of Apple and the way that they look at the engineering of something that has to be unique. It has to be distinctive. It has to be as much artistic as it is functional. And I think that is why people would wait in lines for days in the cold just to plop down $600, $700, $800 or more.
You're right. User friendly. I think just the fact that it's curved around the edges, it seems more personal rather than something that might be rectangular, you know? So they, I'm sure they went over every little detail, right? All I can address is the exterior. I don't know anything about the interior.
Well, you're probably familiar with the fact that Elon Musk has had discussions with Apple, also he being a trendsetter. If you take a look at the history, what kind of culture would have to exist in an organization that at the same time was doing both SpaceX and trying to have a commercially viable electric car that literally blows away everybody else? Mm-hmm. Although it may have taken a couple of years and a few failures along the way, to have that kind of belief and to prevail may have been why Tesla succeeded and Fisker did not.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, we have to take a little break right now, though, Carl. So stay tuned, everybody, for more of It's Your Money, Your Life. We'll be back right after this. All right, we are back with the award-winning It's Your Money, Your Life. And I believe our guest Malcolm has a question for Carl. So, Malcolm, go ahead.
Hey, Carl, it's Malcolm Abner. It's good to hear your voice. I'm missing seeing you in studio here. I have a question for you about something you said earlier, that one of the top reasons that mergers fail is because of a mismatch of culture. And I was just wondering, in your experience, how do you see the merger experts measure and assess whether or not they think cultures are going to fit together?
Question. What it really comes down to is a few things. And again, everything I'm talking in a very 30,000 foot view. There are unique aspects that occasionally occur that causes a mismatch. The employees can either be oriented towards transaction or relationships. Organizations that are more grounded on relationships, both internally and externally, are better candidates, at least in my experience, in a successful merger, whereas if the motivation is transactional, hey, 1 + 1 might equal more than 2, it tends to almost ignore the players. You'll see that in the, so to speak, the language of right-sizing You'll see it in the manner in which compensation is formed post-merger, assuming that there is compensation. I think the question, again, is that what are some of the reasons that it's a mismatch?
Well, no, it's really looking at it in advance. What are some of the ways that the experts sort of gauge whether or not there's going to be a mismatch?
I'm going to go back to one of the items I just shared. If the employees are oriented towards a transaction as opposed to a relationship, I think that has a significant influence because essentially they're mimicking the oversight, the guidance, the principles of leadership within the organization. I would say that is a significant driver. What it is that they manage oftentimes creates the disconnect.
Yeah.
You can manage a lot of things. You can manage how well are you cross-training employees. You could manage whether you're rewarding employees that are doing well financially, but perhaps creating a great deal of contention in the ranks, and that includes the executives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How about an example? The monumental flop that I recall is AOL Time Warner. Why did that not work out?
It's funny that you bring that one up. I actually did a three-day presentation in Beijing, and I think that's a classic example where the motivation was, let's make money. One of them was dealing primarily in what I would argue is blue sky. In other words, the number of subscribers that we claim that we'll be able to accomplish if we continue on our trajectory. And the other one was more of a brick and mortar, old school, that the majority of its value was based on its tangible deliverables, mm-hmm. whether it be the radios, the book, the magazine,
publications.
Two different trajectories that they thought there would be synergy by a merger, and as we know, that did not materialize. Billions were lost as a result of that.
Yeah, ask Ted Turner.
Yeah, no kidding. So, Carl, related to culture, how important is it to have a governing board or an advisory board, and how important is it to have diversity among that group of individuals that are attempting to work together to lead or support organizations?
It's a great question, particularly if you look at, Richard, the family business that's maturing to the extent that they want to go to the next level. And if you have an autocratic type of leadership, that's very, very difficult because oftentimes what you'll find is leadership will surround themselves with individuals that will agree, if you will, whether it be employees, senior staff, or even the advisors that serve them. An example would be the accountant that does not suggest what might serve in the best interest of the organization financially. And so if the board is populated with either family members or individuals that get a seat at the table and also can send invoices as long as they agree, which of course would be legal counsel, it would be the financial advisors, it would be the tax advisors, and in Malcolm's space, it may be advisors that are not only looking at these tangibles, but these intangibles as well. So an advisory board is also oftentimes recommended as well. At the end of the day, if you want to create value, you have to be looking beyond your sense of control. And that means that if you reach a pinnacle whereby you can be served better by having other people handling day-to-day operations, then you should.
Yeah, and I think that's an area where many, many business owners fall down because they tend to hold on to those reins much too long.
I would agree. Or, I mean, there are classic examples where if I'm the best widget maker in the company, then by God, be the best widget maker in the company. But it may be better for the company to have somebody that's going to be in the C-suite that provides professional management.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think family-owned businesses tend to be more challenged by that because there's this perception that bringing in outside non-family members sometimes might have an effect on, well, loyalty, which is an overgeneralization, but sometimes seems to be true.
Oh, absolutely. You've been in that space longer than I have, and you understand that a business is not created for the sole purpose of keeping certain family members employed, and particularly in no-show jobs.
but pardon me, Carl, we've got to wrap up in about 30 seconds.
Carl, what's your best contact information since the merger?
I've got it on the website here.
Shout it out, somebody.
Century Park East, 310-499-4842. Is that right, Carl?
Yes, sir.
And brg-expert.com is his website, folks. So get over there.
And it's Carl at brg-expert.com,
you got
right?
It. And he's on our website, too. We'll talk more about it. We got to take a break. We'll come right
Carl,
back.
Carl, thanks so much. Feel better.
Yes, sir. Feel better. We'll come right back. New sports weather. Hang on. We'll be right back. Hey, we are riding into the second half of this show. Over to Richard to thank our sponsors.
Thank you, sponsors. UBS, Michael Caronta, Drew Freitas. Also in downtown La Jolla, right across the street, Regions Bank with Sean Puckett and Steve Sefton, best business bank in San Diego. Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics, offering tremendous CFO services for growing businesses. Joel Grushkin, whose office I was just hanging out at a day or so ago, Cost Segregation Initiatives, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow. Last week's guest, Brenda Geiger, Law Offices of Brenda Geiger, Estate Planning and Asset Protection. Our favorite CPAs in the planet, right in the midst of tax season, Don Epic and Paul Polito with Polito Epic CPAs up in Vista. Of course, Carl Sheeler's Berkeley Research Group. Joe, shout out Carl's contact information one more time.
Well, if they get over to brg-expert.com and they could find him there, just plug him. You can see the directories right there. Just plug his name and Sheeler. And you'll
but before you say what else is there, I want to thank our newest sponsor, which is the LG Experience and my perfect client, part of the Lombardi Group of clients, helping CPAs and wealth advisors drive much, much better value to their very best clients. We'll talk more about them later as the show continues on every week.
Wonderful.
And so people can come to our website and not only find out about Carl, but they can find out about all of our great sponsors. Right, Joe?
Yes. Just go to iymoney.com. Put your cursor over sponsors. They will all spill out there for you. You click on that, and all their information is there, their background information, their email, their phone number, everything you need to know. And they've been working with Richard for many, many years with great success. Right, Richard?
Yeah. It's been a long time, longer than I want to admit in public. And I probably chatted with six out of our eight sponsors during the course of this past week about various things that we have going on together.
So it's a team, it's a collaboration.
It's a collaborative effort.
Yes.
And, yeah, I'm just, I don't know why they even keep me around because I'm always the dumbest guy in the room.
Yes, but you connect all the dots for
that's
everybody.
True.
So
that's true.
A valuable skill in addition to all your other talent, but enough of that. Hey, how about we introduce
Malcolm Avner. Who the heck is he, Joe? Please inform us.
Well, this gentleman here, he's a conscious company coach. Malcolm works with restless and evolving high achievers who know there is something more to life, but they don't know what it is or how to get it. So over the course of years, he's worked with over 300-plus business owners and senior leaders, and he's developed a comprehensive coaching process to help business leaders enrich their life and make work more meaningful, enjoyable, and effective. You can find out more about him at lifeandbusinessonpurpose.com, lifeandbusinessonpurpose.com. And welcome to our show. Formally, Malcolm, how are you tonight?
I'm doing terrific. Thank you, Joe. Thank you for the embellished introduction.
Just the way I wrote it. No,
exactly.
No, I'm kidding. But anyway, well, you had quite a wonderful life. So, well, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you know your background, where you're born and raised, and educated, and how did you develop into your profession now?
All right. Well, the profession I'm in now is very much an accidental profession. Mm-hmm. It's something that I never intended to be and do. Mm-hmm. And through the course of finding my way to this profession, I've been in a number of companies that I have either started or served in management thereof, and very cross-industry and varying kinds of positions. So I kind of ended up with this very diverse background mm-hmm. that has positioned me to be able to speak to lots of different kinds of business owners in different industries and with different personalities, and right. I've just ended up doing what I found myself very good at doing.
But born and raised where and educated where?
Born and raised in West Texas, okay. In the thriving metropolis of El Paso, Texas.
Outstanding.
And I got my degrees at the University of Dallas in Irving, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
That was business management MBA, economics degree.
Mm-hmm. And then, well, the professions that we find by through serendipitous methods or accidentally, those are the ones we're usually most passionate about or thrive at. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Absolutely. And it's a lesson that, I have learned that I try to convey to my clients, which is don't fight the feeling. You know, mm-hmm. do what's right for you. Do what you're passionate about. And don't try to be something that you're really not really, really good at and enjoy doing.
Joseph Campbell, follow your bliss, right?
There it is.
So do you talk to the clients that you coach about culture at all?
We talk a lot about culture. My approach to thinking about how to make a business successful is really a people-oriented approach. It's about relationships, and the conversation usually starts around relationships within a management team and or an ownership group, and then sort of disseminates into the organization from there. But it starts with those highest level relationships, and that's where kind of the influence, the culture begins to materialize.
And what happens typically when businesses say they have a certain culture, but what actually really exists in terms of how their culture is acted out by daily behavior? What happens when there's inconsistency between the message and the actual action?
Well, that probably only happens the majority of the time.
Okay.
And, you know, what I find is most business owners really come to the table with an intention of, I want to empower my people. I want them to be happy. I want them to be as productive as they could be. And what they don't realize, certainly not until there's outside perspective, is that their actions are detrimental to that intention.
And can you give a common example of a typical action that might be detrimental to a typical stated culture or desire?
Sure. There's a client I worked with recently who, a very senior level manager in a fairly large company. It was maybe $750 million company. And this was someone who had been with the company a long time, lots of great institutional knowledge, loyal, you know, bled company blue kind of thing. And he had risen to the level where his management skills were not up to what the requirements of the job were. And mm-hmm. so he got himself into trouble with employees who were not being, in their view, and realistically respected, empowered, coached, mentored, supported. And instead, this person was kind of using his old style of work, which was kind of take no prisoners, impose his will sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so despite his intentions to want to be helpful, the actions resulted in a lot of discord.
So you and I both walked into the studio carrying the same yellow book.
Yes.
We usually walk into the studio, Joe and I, carrying books, but it's called Conscious Capitalism. What on earth is Conscious Capitalism?
Conscious Capitalism is a genuinely global movement. It's something I found a year ago at their world conference that was held in San Francisco. It was founded by John Mackey, the CEO of Whole Foods, and in partnership with Raj Sisodia, who is a professor of marketing at Bentley University. And Conscious Capitalism is about the idea that businesses that are driven by a higher purpose are going to be the most successful long-term and build value the best long-term.
So by higher purpose, you mean businesses that have a focus on more than just, for example, return on investment?
Exactly. It's an idea that business isn't about making money. Business is about, once you make the money, why are you really there? What will you do with the money?
And I know that's a tough one for a lot of people because in many cases, people who build companies are very, very focused. And they're very focused on the one thing that they're building and growing. And they get to a certain point where they sort of wake up one morning and go, well, what else is there?
That's a big part of it. And the part that's really compelling for me, Richard, is that it's actually the best way to make money and to really respect the higher purpose of why am I here as a CEO or owner of this business, and what is the purpose of this business within the ecosystem of the broader community that is our partners and is our local residential community, that when integrating all that, there's really the best path to to making money long term too.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I really enjoyed reading Conscious Capitalism. I bought it at Whole Foods when I was picking up some kale and quinoa for my daughter. I'm still eating pizza. I'm trying, but they have great pizza at Whole Foods too. But there's four specific tenets I noticed of Conscious Capitalism when reading this book. I'm going to list them real quickly, but I want to talk to you about the first one. They are respectively higher purpose, stakeholder integration, conscious leadership, and then conscious culture and management. So when we talk about culture and higher purpose, those things sort of go hand in hand, correct?
Well, they should.
They should.
And higher purpose is kind of the mystery concept here. That's the one that a lot of people don't really have their arms around. A lot of business owners, they will have a purpose of, yeah, I want to make money. Yeah, I want to enjoy my work. Higher purpose is about...
Let's hold that mystery, though, because we have to take a break right now, then, Malcolm, and come back, then we'll hear the answer to this mystery right after this break. Hang on.
Okay.
Well, we are back with Life and Business and Coach Malcolm Abner. I left one out. What's the third one there, Malcolm? Life, business, and...
Leadership.
Leadership.
Okay, sorry.
But anyway,
that.
Malcolm wants to tell us about higher purpose. Because, well, I think that's a very important topic.
Well, it's the starting point for conscious capitalism. And higher purpose, I just want to draw a distinction here, is not something that we think about. It's not something that we come up with through what are we interested in or kind of what do we think we should be doing with our time and our lives. Higher purpose is something that we know through our heart, not our heads. And higher purpose is something that we recognize really with a kind of an emotional and a whole body, okay, yeah, that feels good. And that's something that's very personal. And in terms of conscious capitalism, we're talking about higher purpose for the CEO, and that then becomes the basis for the company purpose.
And so the next basic tenet is stakeholder integration. Explain that briefly, but what I found fascinating about stakeholders, the definition of all the many, many, the myriad of different kinds of stakeholders that can be involved.
In conscious capitalism, no party is excluded. A stakeholder is anybody who has any involvement with the company. And so that goes beyond the typical viewpoint of investors and employees. In conscious capitalism, it includes the vendors and the suppliers. It includes the community that a company resides in. It even includes regulators and the government. A stakeholder is anybody who is involved with the company, and in conscious capitalism, those are seen as partners, not as competitors or adversaries.
Yeah, and what was fascinating to me is the book describes about how the competition can be viewed as a stakeholder, which is totally 180 degrees from what most companies view the competition as. Usually it's mortal combat with your enemy.
Yeah, it's not an enemy unless you seek to make it as such. Mm-hmm. And a lot of successful companies, and you can look at Apple and how they've come to work with Microsoft, it's a matter of making the pie bigger for everybody to succeed more rather than expend resources fighting against other people in your industry.
Yeah, and it's how the competition can make you better, because if you can see what they're doing better than you and then improve what you're doing, it raises the level of expertise and value that everybody's providing at that point to the community.
Yeah, and you can do that in a collaborative way, or you could do it in a sneaky way. Mm-hmm. In conscious capitalism, it's a collaborative way.
Right, exactly. The third one, conscious leadership. What's that all about?
Conscious leadership is really the second stage of observing and implementing purpose. So a conscious leader is someone who is very in touch with what's the higher purpose of that person's life, and is he or she really bringing that into the culture of the company? And
We had an interesting guest about a month ago. Actually, we had promoted their event that was in San Diego about a month ago, Servant Leadership Institute. They talk a lot about how to flip the leadership hierarchy so that leaders of organizations are actually serving all of the stakeholders. I would imagine servant leadership is at least a consistent theme with conscious leadership.
Certainly. A conscious leader is someone who wakes up in the morning and shows up at work with the mandate of how can I make the people around me better and most successful. And that happens through service and through support, not through giving orders.
Right. The old command and control typically doesn't seem to work the way it used to.
Now, Malcolm, you lead the San Diego chapter of Conscious Capitalism, correct?
Is it? The San Diego chapter is in formation,
okay.
And I'm sort of carrying the flag for that.
Great. Now, there's an event you would want to tell us about right before we get...
Let's do the last tenet, and we have plenty of time for the event.
Okay.
Last one, number four, Conscious Culture and Management.
Yeah, this really ties in well with what Carl was speaking about earlier, that culture is the link between conscious leadership and company performance. And it's sort of the group consciousness is how I like to think about culture. It's the consciousness of all the individuals combined into its own entity. And conscious culture is one that really is respectful of the other tenets, the tenets of stakeholder integration and really being cognizant of the company's values, principles, and what are the routines of practice, and are those really fully intentional and fully consistent with with higher purpose?
And I know Rod Sisodia did a 15-minute TED Talk that's amazing. I would recommend anybody and everybody to check that out. I also know that studies have been done when it gets down to making money. Studies have been done that companies that actually follow these kinds of basic tenets over the long term, they tend to outperform companies that have more short-term, shall we say, old-fashioned horizons.
Yeah, Raj Sisodia did all the research. He's the academic here, and he did the research of 130 public companies and published that in his predecessor book called Firms of Endearment, which is the data on which conscious capitalism is based. And he actually, the data showed that conscious companies with conscious leaders outperform companies that don't have that same criteria and character by a factor of 10.
Yeah, it's amazing the difference. So the event, I know coming up next month, this is March 1st, so it's technically next month in April, so it's a little bit more than a month away. Big event coming up here in San Diego, right?
Well, it's the Global Conference for Conscious Capitalism, and it truly is global. When I was at the event last year, there were met people from literally every corner of the planet. And this event will be April 9 through April 11th. It's being held at the Paradise Point Resort. And the organizers have decided to change the character of the event, and they're really sort of limiting attendance this year. There were a couple of thousand of us last year, and this year it's limited to about 550. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of keynote speakers, and the really powerful part of the event is a series of practicums provided by just some really first-rate experts about culture and about building businesses and about fulfilling lives within businesses.
Mm-hmm. If people are interested, should they just go to your website or to the consciouscapitalism.org website? Or
people can go either way. There's a link on my website, which is lifeandbusinessonpurpose.com. There's a link to Conscious Capitalism on my homepage. And otherwise, registration can happen online at consciouscapitalism.org.
Mm-hmm. Can you mention briefly some of the keynote speakers and workshop leaders?
I see some of them. There's Walter Robb, co-CEO of Whole Foods.
Yeah.
Do you have one? Do you have any more over there? I have them on the website.
Some of the usual suspects. There will be...
your friend Raj Sisodia, Richard, will be there.
Absolutely.
Co-author of the book that you're talking about tonight.
Casey Sheehan, and the CEO, who's the CEO of Patagonia, is one of the speakers, also one of the board members of Conscious Capitalism.
How about this one? Chief People Officer of JetBlue, Ann Rhodes. That sounds like a cool person.
Man, I love JetBlue. I absolutely love JetBlue. When I flew back from the Boston Marathon 2 years ago, I was on JetBlue. I wouldn't have survived on an airplane that didn't give people leg room and service.
Well, she cut her teeth at Southwest Airlines, where she was head of people the people department.
Great. Well, Malcolm, thank you so much for being our guest. Best of success with your event. And
again, consciouscapitalism.org.
Right. And thank you to Carl Sheeler also for being our guest tonight. And Richard, thank you for being our host tonight.
My pleasure. Let's see how we do with our Academy Award predictions.
Yes. And stay dry out there, everybody. And so thank you to Justin Hart, who has been great on the board tonight. Thanks to Craig Blinker, account executive. Thank you to Dave Sniff, our programming genius here. And I'd like to leave you with a quote by Peter Drucker. The best way to predict the future is to create it. So get out there and be creative, folks. Have a great week. We'll see you next week. Stay dry. Good night.